Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today we were going to bring you a conversation with eminent Australian writer Alex Miller, but we've asked Alex to join us at the same time next week because you might have heard that on Saturday, one of the lions of American letters, Norman Mailer, died aged 84. Norman Mailer spoke with a very loud voice on American life in the 20th century through his journalism, opinions and writing on politics, history and popular culture. His body of work in fiction is daunting. In 1948, he wrote what many people see as the definitive war novel, his first novel, The Naked and the Dead, and he went on to write the massive Egyptian novel Ancient Evenings, his CIA investigation Harlot's Ghost, his Gary Gilmore murder novel The Executioner's Song, The Gospel According to the Sun, his retelling of the New Testament in the first-person voice of Jesus Christ, and his last novel, The Castle in the Forest, published this year, a novel about Hitler's childhood. Although he'd best like to be remembered, I imagine, for his novels, it's his journalism that many people rate most highly. With Tom Wolfe, he was in the 1960s one of the pioneers of the new journalism. His books Armies of the Night on the 1967 anti-Vietnam march on the Pentagon and on the moonshot in Of a Fire on the Moon are written with the heart and the eye of a novelist. In 1955, Norman Mailer co-founded The Village Voice and he was editor of Dissent from 1952 until 1963. He was jailed in 1967 for his role in demonstrations against the war in Vietnam and he was president of the US chapter of PEN from 1984 to 1986. I spoke to Norman Mailer in the year 2000 in Edinburgh when he was 77 years old. While he was crippled with arthritis in both hips and had to use two walking sticks, when he sat down on the stage, he became his younger self, clever and charming and warm. And on that stage, the writer with reputation for boozing and boxing and womanising said he was more interested in balance, less interested in politics, didn't do drugs, and had written himself out of the sexual revolution. My first question to him was about his commitment to truth-telling.
Discovering the truth is about as simple as getting to know a woman well. In other words, it's close to impossible. Truth is a mystery. You see, we approach the truth. We never find it. A friend of mine, a dear friend of mine named Jean Malaquet, he was a compulsive writer. He wrote with enormous difficulty. He was tremendously intelligent, immensely cultivated, and as a result had a hard time writing. Because every time he'd write a sentence, he would think of how Gide, or for that matter, Cervantes, had done a better sentence. And so he'd write maybe 200, 300, 400 words a day, and he'd spend 12 hours at the desk, 14 hours at the desk. And I once said to him, and his books did not do that well, and I once said to him, why do you keep writing? You can do so many other things. And he looked at me in horror, and he said, oh, he said, I have to keep writing. He said, because the only time I know the truth is at the point of my pen. And I thought about the remark for years, because it is true that you often will write something, and at a given moment you'll say to yourself, that's true, and how do I know that? That doesn't mean that it's true. It means that you had one moment when you felt that you were in the presence of the truth. Because I think for writers, truth is the equivalent of grace for someone who's immensely religious. But you, as I say, you try to find the truth. And I love the novel, because I think the novel's a far better way of coming close to the truth than history or the essay or biography or any of the other forms, mainly because the novel insists upon having, if it's good, insists upon having some sort of inner construction that you can feel when you're violating this inner construction. And so you will get a sense of this belongs in the novel or doesn't belong. At the end of it, you don't feel that you've written the truth. You feel you've written a space station, if you will, from which people can come a little closer to the truth.
Mm. You've said that not speaking the truth is harmful. I think from a line in Deer Park, experience when it's not communicated to another must wither within and be worse than lost.
Yes.
So you're compelled to tell the truth.
No, you're not compelled to tell the truth, and particularly if you're married, you most certainly are not compelled to tell the truth. because, you know, marriage has many advantages and many virtues, and we don't have to get into that, but it does have one dreadful disadvantage, which is if you're married, you have a roommate, and you can no more tell a wife or a mate the truth than you can tell it to a roommate who you're going to be living with all semester. It can't be done because one of the fiercest passions in life, I've decided at the age of 77, is that passion that people have to defend their ego. You see, most people have a tremendous amount of difficulty building a serviceable ego to carry them through the obstacles of the day. And any time you tell people the truth, you're injuring the ego, because the ego is a wonderful nest of small distortions and lies about yourself.
You started off as a nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn and a good student at Harvard, and you had a mother...
And now I'm with a nice Jewish girl from Australia.
You are. But you had a mother who really believed in you, didn't you? And I think that really helped generate and fertilize and nourish this ego of yours.
Oh, absolutely. But the trouble was I had an ego that was lopsided, because at home I was everything, and out on the street I was just one more guy. And everyone has a sad story. The sad story of my ego is precisely that I had to find a way to live with one ego rather than two.
Convince the world ego. Well, to think like your mother.
Yes, well, that's why I became a writer, yes.
How important was it, though, for that strong belief in you?
Well, her belief, she was a marvelous woman. I don't want to get into it. She was an extraordinary woman, hardworking, cheerful, full of love. If I'd ever gone up into a tower in Texas and shot 20 students down below, my mother would have said, "What did they do to get Norman so upset?" And that was her vice.
When I was reading the Gospel according to the Son, I thought about Jesus, and of course he had a mother who thought the world of him too.
Yes, yes indeed.
And I wondered, you know, I thought, yeah, of course you were the right person to write that book.
Well, the thing is, whenever you do a book, there are parts of it that are comfortable for you and parts that are uncomfortable, where you're pushing and straining. I remember Graham Greene wrote about that somewhere or other, that he had characters who came to him naturally, and he could do a lot with them. And then there were characters that he had a lot of trouble with. He had to work on them all the time. And when he'd read a review of his novel, and the reviewer would say that the particular character that he personally had a hard time with was well-drawn, Green would say to himself, well-dragged. So there's that the parts of a novel just are easy and parts that are much more difficult. And in that book, The Gospel According to the Son, for me, the easiest part was the relation of the mother to the son. And I was happy for that, because the rest of the book wasn't all that easy.
Yeah. You have got such ambition. I mean, you tackle such huge subjects. I wanted to talk about truth, reality, the novel, mm-hmm. and journalism. Because, I mean, you're a pioneer in this methodology of writing nonfiction as if it's a novel. Fiction and using real
yeah.
people in it. Tell me about, you know, how you make that leap to decide, let's talk about the nonfiction, to write things as if they are fictional, and have Norman Mailer or the reporter in the third person.
As a young writer, I grew up under the dark shadow of Time magazine. At that time in America, a Time magazine presented itself as a wholly objective presence. In other words, people who wrote the stories for Time magazine did not even have their names listed. I'm talking now about the early 50s. It was so that you got the impression when you read Time magazine that this was the sole truth. This was the only truth. No use looking anywhere else. This is the truth you were going to have. Now, since they'd said some abominable things about me in the course of all this, and I knew that they weren't true, that bad as I might be here or there, I wasn't bad that way, I knew viscerally there was something wrong with what they were doing. And then when I started covering a few events, notably the Democratic Convention in 1960, I noticed that reporters, who are often by the nature of their work lonely people, all gathered together, and they sort of swapped their impressions. It was almost like a story market. You know, I can't use this story because my editor won't permit it, so I give it to you, and now I've got a marker, and you owe me a story either this trip or the next one that we're together. And so I began to realize that there was a kind of communality to the stories. And they very often had very little to do with the reality. Specifically, they would have all decided, in their cups, that Jack Kennedy was an ass. He was a rich ass. He was a spoiled son of a very rich man and didn't have much on the ball. and it was a joke that they felt. And I, coming there as an innocent, was looking at it, and I realized they had no clothes, that they were absolutely wrong, that Kennedy was young, he was vital, and what was crucial to it is he was handsome. He was handsome and he had a beautiful wife. And I knew enough about America to know that movies in America were at least as powerful a force in American motivation as politics. And so I understood that after Eisenhower and Mamie Eisenhower, who had been stayed when all is said, that Kennedy was going to have an immense effect on American mores. And so I wrote it that way. And in the course of it, since I had plenty of time to write my piece, I had one advantage over all the reporters who had to file their story each day. I had 3 weeks to do my story. And so I just blossomed, you know, what am I good for? I'm good at description, at least I was in those days. And so I gave long descriptions of how everyone looked, how the gangsters looked who were at the convention, you know, and how the girls who'd been hired to plump for the various candidates looked. That continued this. I remember 4 years later writing about Goldwater's girls, that they looked like hookers on horses. and so I had great fun with it. You know, it was open. And I had all the freedom that you have. A novelist never has any freedom because they're always worried about where their story is going. Because if you make a mistake in your story and you take your protagonist, male or female, into the wrong place on a given chapter, then you can lose 6 months before you realize you made a dreadful error, that you don't know enough to write well about what the character is doing next. But here, it's as if Providence or the Lord writes the story for you, and you have it. And so you can relax about the story, and therefore there's every opportunity in the world to devote yourself to the details. And so it was a feast of details, and I just loved it, and it was an easy kind of journalism. And to this day, I have a certain, I wouldn't say contempt, but I have a certain, I never take it too seriously. I always feel that my novels are more important to me than my journalism, because the journalism is easier. You are given the story, which is half of the difficulty in writing.
So why the third person? Why, say, the
reporter? Why write about myself in the third person? Let me take it by reverse. I think I can give you an interesting answer. Third person and first person are at least as different in writing as major and minor keys in music. And I won't pretend to say which is which, because in certain situations, first person can be more major, and others, third person is more a major key. But the point is, you have to have a sense of the reader, the event, and yourself, and what will form the best triangulation. When I was doing the Gospel According to the Son, people said to me, how did you have the nerve to write about Jesus in the first person? You know, who did you think you are? And I said, no, it was absolutely, so far as I know, it was absolutely a practical decision that I chose the first person because I wanted Jesus the man to be predominant in the book, not Jesus the Son of God, because I always felt that was the first example of a truly powerful divided personality, which is on the one hand he was a man, on the other hand he was the Son of God. So I felt I'm not equipped to write about the Son of God, but maybe I can do something about the man. Now to do that, you have to have an immediacy, and the strength of the first person is that it gives you great immediacy. The moment you pick up a book and someone's saying I, the reader jumps into the I and feels at home. Now they really get very bored with the I because it's a constraining form, but in the beginning at least, you always have easy access with the first person. So I thought, all right, what I will avoid there, and people, this was the reason I put it in the first person, is if I'd written it in the third person, it would have gotten mixed up with the Gospels. And people would be very irritated reading the book because they would not know which part, since I was quoting from the Gospels particularly all through it, which part was written by the author and which part came from the Gospels, and where was Jesus in all this. Whereas in the first person, you had to either accept it or reject it. And I always work on the assumption that if only 50% of the people who pick up one of my books reject it, then I've got a good book. Because I don't want, you know, my idea of an uneasy book would be one that the majority of people would accept. At any rate, why did I do it in the third person? For the politics. Yeah. I sure can talk, can't I?
It's okay. I'm used to it. I'm fine. I like to hear you talk.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
That's what we're here for.
I wrote in the third person for journalism because my feeling was that one had to, and this goes back to Time magazine, one had to try to break down that notion that the reporter is an objective eye, because it's just not true. Everybody sees through their warp, through their bias, through their pretensions, through their needs, all of it. And it seemed to me that if I presented myself in the book and wrote about myself in the third person, I could then begin, what the reader would get is they would perceive a character who was viewing an event. And that is the way we perceive all the time in life. The way we learn everything in life, or not everything, but we certainly can do a lot of serious reading, but generally speaking, the way we learn most of the stuff we learn in life is through casual talk and chatter and gossip with friends. And if a friend tells us a story about another friend, since we know the friend who's telling us the story very well, we can say to ourselves, oh, he or she doesn't know a damn thing about this or that. And so I know more there, and I know what really happened at that moment better than they did. And on the other hand, we'll listen very carefully when we feel the friend has a certain authority. And that's because we know the friend. And I thought the least reporters should be are not knowledgeable, but knowable friends to the reader. And I wanted that kind of journalism. And in fact, to a certain extent, it took over in America. You know, in the Village Voice, which I was a part, we began to have a style where we went too far in the other direction. So before it was all over, if you picked up a typical Village Voice story, if it had, and we had long stories, if it had 10,000 words, 8,000 were devoted to the writer and 2,000 to the event. And that was the abuse. But I felt that the corrective was exactly that you know who the... not only you know who the storyteller is, but you see them objectively. And the third person's wonderful for... giving an objective sense of reality.
And you were not backward in being very telling the truth about that third person. I mean, you said some very revealing things about that third person. He sometimes didn't behave well.
You know, the secret is that the more you reveal about yourself, the more you have to move on.
How do you mean?
And it's almost as much of an advantage as a disadvantage to reveal yourself in print. Because then people say, oh, I know him. I know him so well. He's just out there in his book. What I'm going to do to him, but by the time they get to you, you're different.
And, so and you've probably done it to yourself, what they were going to do to you.
No, I don't worry about it. I discovered it's a way of living that's as reasonable as any other way. I mean, there are two ways to handle the side of yourself that you don't want to make too available. One of it is to hide it, which most people do. But the other side, and it's dangerous in the beginning because you don't know what you're doing, but if you let it all hang out, so to speak, then you're no longer that person. You've moved on.
But in a sense, your readers are saying, well, this guy's telling me pretty hard truths about himself, and he's probably telling me hard truths about what he's describing as well.
You're absolutely right. That's the advantage of it, that if you're not defending yourself, then it does give you the sanction to attack others.
You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Ramona Koval here, and we're listening to an interview from the year 2000 from Edinburgh International Book Festival with Norman Mailer, who died over the weekend, aged 84. At this point in the conversation, I said that he was a passionate advocate of truth-telling, but it seems to have been fueled by testosterone.
Testosterone? Oh, I don't know about that. There's never enough testosterone.
You said in advertisements for myself that the only revolution which will be meaningful and natural for the 20th century will be the sexual revolution, one sensed everywhere. How do you think the sexual revolution's going at this point at the end of the century or at the beginning of the new one, depending on
how you count? I think it's gotten a bit cheesy around the edges.
Yeah.
And well, you know, I'm older now, and so naturally... I no longer see myself as a protagonist in the sexual revolution, and therefore I tend to be much more critical of it. And but finally you end up in that, you know, to grow old is if you're going to stay reasonably comfortable as when you're old, you automatically become more moderate in all your points of view. You become fascinated with balance. And so I think that the sexual revolution works best when it's in opposition, because... sex is such a dark, gritty, complex, exciting, paradoxical, and oftentimes on the edge of perverse set of activities that and there's so many pollutants in the act of sex, the power drive, the immediacy of love that's not really love. I mean, you can go into all the complications of sex and it's endless. And so it's best if there's something ennobling about sex. And in the old days, what was ennobling is we were fighting the system. You know, our feeling was, because I wasn't alone in this feeling, that in the course of freeing sex, we would free mankind, humankind, that men and women would be happier and better, and terrible, deadening social institutions would be diminished. So, all right, so all that happened. The sexuality in America now is rampant. It is all over Europe. But it no longer means anything. In other words, if one has the equipment and the desire to have a good time sexually, one can have it much more easily now than ever before. But it's not ennobled any longer. And so I don't look with horror on the possibility that a repression is going to come, and then we can have our sexual revolution all over again at a higher level. But everything is too easy these days on the one hand, and on the other hand, much more difficult than it ever used to be because of technology. Mm. You know, the amount of time that we spend losing our nerve ends, swearing at technological machines that don't quite work perfectly, the amount of time we spend in reparations of our psyche and of the machines is beginning to take over our sensual equipment. So I left us on a dead end, didn't I?
That's all right. I can come.
You can
come
take care
there.
Of it. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you reckon about the men's movement and you know that?
What
that
men's movement? You know, the women have won everything.
No.
The women.
There's
the
men's
women,
movement
the
in your country. I mean, there's a thing about returning to masculinity. You know.
The men in America have had their. They've gone. What have they done? They've gone into their dugouts and they've pulled the metal covers over. We're letting the women just rampage over the landscape in America. They're taking care of everything. They don't understand that they'll never get the real power, because the people who have the real power now in America are the corporate executives, and they are canny. They are highly tuned mediocrities. You see, and there's one thing about a mediocrity. You can take power from someone who's a powerful person because they take chances, real chances. That's how they got to be powerful, and that's their pride in themselves, is that they are large. But you cannot take power from an entrenched mediocrity. They work at it 24 hours a day, keeping the power. And so the women now are all in their marvelous little black tailored suits with their laptop computers, and they go on the airplanes, and they've invaded the corporation, and they slowly rise to higher and higher levels, but they'll never reach the summit because those mediocrities are there, and they're playing them. And the women's revolution's been sold for a mess of corporate pottage. So, but the men, as I say, are all underground at this point. They're hiding themselves. Probably the intensity of anti-feminine feeling in America now is probably greater than anti-Semitism, which is also undercover.
But you've got this new guy who's standing for Vice P.
Well, this is going to be fascinating because Americans are going to learn for the first time whether they're right, whether we're going to learn something from the election. Rather than deciding who's going to be the next president, what we're going to learn is America more or less anti-Semitic than we think it is, each of us individually. In other words, if Gore wins, it's a sure sign that the buried anti-Semitism in America is not that intense. And if he loses by a hell of a lot, the reverse is true.
What do you think about it? I mean, where do you...
I don't have an opinion. I have a question. I'm curious about the outcome.
Yeah. Are you still curious about American politics after all these years?
Not as much. I mean, it's finally American politics is being subsumed and engorged and devoured by corporatism. It's the corporate mind that's taking over America. I think that the presidency as such, that the dirty little secret in American national life now is to keep the notion of the presidency important. You know, it's comparable, if I can intrude on your turf, it's comparable to the way about the time that the monarchy ceased to mean anything in terms of real political power in England, that it became so sacrosanct. After all, in the old days, they were beheading kings. They wouldn't dream of doing it now. Don't behead the poor bugger. He's never done a thing to us. So the same thing's going to happen in America. We have candidates now who are closer ideologically than any two candidates I can remember in my time. And the reason is because they don't matter. They each are going to serve the corporation. And the corporation is going to determine what foreign policy is, what economic policy is. They will sooner or later, although they're not too good at it, take over our artistic policy. At present, they're content to just make sure that the majority of books that are sold are bestsellers and will improve no one's mind at a disastrously quick rate. I'll repeat that, will improve no one's mind at a disastrously quick rate.
Your country, I mean, it strikes me, I mean, whenever I go there, it's a country that's in love with itself.
Oh my God, the narcissism of America, it's revolting. No, I mean, we are the greatest, most powerful country in the world, ipso facto. We have the most money, we have large resources to develop, we have everything.
It's a kind of mantra that you hear all the time.
Oh, yeah. We have to do this for America, yeah. We're like a giant who is afraid that he or she will pee in their pants if they meet someone who's half their size. And I find it disgusting. You started, Reagan was the worst. I mean, he was the Pied Piper. You know, when he went into, remember he lost about 250 Marines who were bombed in Lebanon, and 2 days later he invaded Grenada, which is a tiny island about twice the size of Edinburgh, and he said we're fighting communism, and there were 1,200 Cuban construction workers there, and he sent in 1,800 Marines, and of course they won the island in about a day and a half, and he said, we have now overcome the shame of Vietnam. America is triumphant again. You know, it's enough to, as someone once said, I wish I could eat more so I could throw up more. Thank you for the applause, but I can't remember who said it.
But you love America, but you write about America
well,
so much.
It's like a wife you'd like to throw out the window and rescue. in midair.
There's been a lot of things being, you know, a lot of vertigo in your novels, too, this throwing out the window business.
Well, everyone.
Where does that come from?
Everyone has their little specialties.
Yeah. Can you remember the first window you wanted to throw someone out of? Or you wanted to throw yourself out of?
Never wanted to throw myself out a window. I was afraid that there might be forces in me that would encourage me to throw myself out a window, but I never wanted to go out the window.
Not you.
I mean, I don't know anyone, you know, people who suffer vertigo obviously are under two spells at once. One is to protect themselves, and the other is to dare the unknown, to put the nicest face you can upon it. So no, parapets and windows can be difficult, especially when you're young.
And when you're on drugs.
And when you're...
You're out of your mind on drugs.
On drugs. Well, I haven't been out of my mind on drugs in something like 35 years now.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I'm really interested in whether... I mean, how did you take those risks with your brain? Weren't you worried that... I mean, what you were...
Oh, we all...
Had at risk was the very thing that made you want to write and live?
Look, we all take risks with our brain all the time, as we do with our bodies. I remember that I did my most serious boxing when I was from 50 to 58. I didn't do much boxing earlier. I did a little, but... Between 50 and 58, I used to go to a gym and box on Saturdays. And I remember we'd go out afterward, and we'd have lunch, hot dogs or hamburgers and orange juice, and sit around, and a little beer sometimes. And we'd talk about whatever. We were a club. And I remember once saying to this club, I said, fellas, what would it feel like, because we always boxed on Saturday morning, what would it feel like to have no headache on Saturday afternoon? Because that would happen. You'd box a few rounds, and you'd have a headache afterward because you get hit a few times on the head. And then it occurred to me that the headache was no worse, in fact, was less bad than the headaches I used to have automatically every night I'd gone out and drunk heavily. So, all right, for years I have been bombarding my brain with booze and deadening it, and to this day my brain is not what it ought to be because of all that booze I drunk. And let's say 80% of it is due to the booze and 20% to the boxing. But... On the other hand, you get certain things out of the booze, and you get certain things out of, and it is, and you know, we are our own currency in a certain sense. We spend the money of our mind and our body in order to acquire new possibilities for ourselves. Sometimes we win, sometimes we lose, but that's what we all do all the time. We're always expending ourselves and discovering new resources, and that's when we're relatively happy. And then we're expending ourselves and discovering no new resources, and that's when we're depressed. I mean, there is an internal psychic economy, if you will.
Norman Mailer speaking to me, age 77, at the Edinburgh International Book Festival in the year 2000. He died over the weekend. This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval.
That the book, The Fight, was quite an extraordinary description, loving description of the choreography of fighting. And I was wondering where you get that part of you that can break down things into smaller and smaller events, you know, and describe the whole thing as it's happening like a whole, like a punch.
Well, you can't do it just by watching the fight. You know, there's a lot to it in that. I remember I got a movie of that fight, and I studied that movie. I studied it by the hour. I must have spent 25 hours looking at that fight in the movies, because it's just as if you were to read. Well, if you were to take 5 pages of Finnegan's Wake and skim it quickly, that's analogous to what you get watching a fight once. There might be all the excitement of reading it for the first time, but you don't begin to know what the 5 pages say. You'd have to study them and study them and study them. And boxers at that level, fighters at that level, are working at so many high levels, psychologically, physically, intellectually, and also in terms of the emotions, whether they're feeling confidence or fear, that you really have to study it, as I say, over and over and over again, each time looking through to see which staff you're on. You know, are you on the physical staff, the mental staff, so forth. So that's how those details come in. There's a lot of work to it. It's like putting a mosaic together.
Yeah. I wonder whether it was your training as an engineer.
Could be. I don't know.
You know,
Could be. I think I'm structural to a degree. I tend to look at things and how do you put them together, and that could well be it. That the engineering did have some good.
How did you start an engineering degree?
Oh, when I was a kid, I used to build model airplanes, and I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. So I went to Harvard. I had 2 choices. I could have gone to MIT, and then I probably would have become an aeronautical engineer, or Harvard, where I knew the education for an engineer would not be as good, but the girls in Brooklyn, on my block, had almost no reaction to MIT, and when I said I might go to Harvard, they lit up and they saw me with new eyes.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
I mean, I was 16 years old, and I had the motivations of a 16-year-old. So I ended up taking engineering at Harvard and got bored with it quickly and took the minimum of courses and took writing courses. Came out badly educated. The engineering I didn't remember, and then the writing courses were fine, but there's an awful lot I never learned at Harvard.
What about that Moon book, though? Were you stimulated by the engineering part of it as well? I mean, I know you were fascinated by the characters who were...
You know, it gave me a certain... when I did the book Of a Fire on the Moon about the flight of Apollo 11 to the moon, yes, the engineering came in very handy, because there were terribly dull, difficult technical manuals you had to read if you wanted to understand what was going on. And that was some help. It was equivalent to having taken Latin in high school if you later in life decided you wanted to try to translate a Latin verse.
The fight book and the fascination with boxing and warriorship, in a sense.
Well, about the time the warrior disappears in man completely, so the technological universe will predominate over everything. The two are opposed, essentially.
Why?
Why? Hmm. Because technology controls us from outside, and the entire notion of the warrior is the warrior controls his, and you can now say her, environment immediately and directly. And they prevail or they are defeated in warring with their environment. But that's the basic notion of war, of violence and of combat. The idea is that you are a free soul in the world of of contact. You are not being done to from outside. Technology does just that. It tells you how to live. It tells you how to breathe. The mark of a truly technological hotel is that you can't open the windows. Well, I'm not laughing. It's no fun. But sooner or later, somebody's going to throw a brick through one of those windows, and it'll be a scandal.
So there are inevitabilities in the design of technology? We can't design a human-centered technology?
No, we can't. I'd go that far.
Why?
Because it's coming to us from outer space. No, I really think, they put it this way, that there are two wars, there are two desires that are very much at war with one another in human nature. And one of them is individuality and freedom and the sense of being close to one's senses and close to, ultimately close to eternity, close to fundamentals. That's one side of it. And the other side is to control environments so there's no danger for anyone, anywhere, ever. And it leaves out of the equation the fact that we are born and we die. And then, so we live in a fundamental mystery that's not resolvable, because none of us know where we're going to go when we die. Technology attempts to say to you, you may never die. Trust in us, trust in technology, and you may live to be 150 or 200 and quite the equal of a 50-year-old. This is the essential promise of technology. It's totally false. You can't get something for nothing. There's the law of the conservation of energy.
Do you feel wise?
Wise? It's my vice, yes.
Well, what's it like to have...
It's a nice vice.
Is it, isn't it? What's it like to have gotten a little bit older? Do you feel like you do understand the world better?
Yes, yeah. Well, I think the thing that keeps you going is that each 5 years or so, you molt and have a new set of ideas that are more interesting than the last set. Now, they may not be more interesting. If you were to write them down, you might be depressed to see that they're less interesting than the old ideas. But since you often don't do that, what you just do is live with the new ideas. There is this feeling that that you're alive. If the mind's alive when you're old, you feel alive.
You believe in reincarnation?
Yes.
Do you think you've been here before?
I don't know. That's the question everyone asks themselves who starts to get interested in reincarnation. You don't know. You don't know if you're a first time out or whether you've been around for a long time. You have intimations each way.
And what are your intimations?
They go each way. There are days when I think, yeah, this is the first time around. I'm so dumb. And then there are other times when I think, no, I must be an old soul. So, but this is, this is like smelling your armpit. It's not terribly productive. Oh, I didn't mean to say... Please, I was not insulting you, for the record.
But it's
I meant for me, it was not productive to think in that direction. Not that your question was useless. Far from it.
Thank you so much for making that clear.
The late, great Norman Mailer, who died at the weekend aged 84, speaking to me there in the year 2000 at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. And we'll put a longer version of that interview up on the website at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.